Dark Wings.
Dark Words.
A Game of Thrones podcast.
Episode 4.
Cripples.
Bastards.
And broken things.
Alright, welcome to episode 4. I am Chuck Davis, and with us this week is...
Chad Spagara.
Molly Welsh.
Brendan Riley.
And Eric Salonis.
Excellent episode this week, very exciting.
We all agree on that.
Story time in Westeros.
Some questions that we've had from previous podcasts were answered this week. And a couple of interesting phenomena are developing. The biggest of which, I think, is the way that they're introducing, creating, manufacturing new scenes that didn't exist in the book at all.
Oh, yeah.
They basically cherry-pick two of their characters that are going to be mainstay characters throughout the TV version, and they just have them have a little conversation that's all exposition, right?
Yeah, which is...
We saw that several times this week from some unexpected places. The biggest one I can think of is Sir Alistair Thorne. He had like a huge monologue two-thirds of the way through the episode.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, wow, they're giving this character that I wasn't even sure they were going to include in the show, you know, some pretty juicy dialogue to chew through. That was very cool. But, I mean, we've got...
Was the scene with Jaime and Jory...
That was
in the books?
Completely not
completely invented, I think.
Yeah.
But the conversation they had is similar to one that's in the books, where two characters are describing the Battle of Pyke, right? Or the Siege of Pyke?
I do remember them talking about the Siege of Pyke in the book. So
and,
I remember
and
Jamie talking about it.
Someone reflects to, oh, did you see Thoros of Myr when he went through the hole in the gates or whatever?
Right.
And, oh, that flaming sword, that's an image I'll never forget. Which is interesting because Thoros of Myr is introduced in the series as a combatant in the games of the new King's Hand.
Yeah.
And so he's... Yeah, the hand's turning, which we don't get to see. The turning actually was given very short shrift, I thought.
Oh,
far too short.
What we saw. I mean, I'm hoping that's not the end of it, that it picks up, because it wasn't over when the episode was over.
Can somebody... refresh my memory. What did we miss from the tourney, and what was the significance of seeing the mountain kill Hugh of the Vale?
Because he was John Arryn's squire, and now Eddard can't question him.
Well, and the whole Sansa sitting right there, and it's not all she thought it was going to be.
Right.
And
wait, wasn't that a Sansa chapter in the book?
Yeah,
where we saw that
mm-hmm.
where he died right in front of her,
yeah.
Bloody and gross and awesome, and Arya's like. Oh, Sansa's like, ew! And yeah. I really liked how gory and bubbly and gross that
was. Great.
Well, but what would Sir Hugh of the Vale have had to say to the King's Hand had he had the opportunity to talk with him?
I think Eddard just wanted more information about the circumstances of Jon Arryn's death.
I know, but do we know that he had some juicy tidbit of information that he was unable to...
I don't
convey.
Know if he necessarily knew that he knew something.
Baelish was pointing Eddard toward him, so there was something that
Baelish
wanted
him to. But that's like classic
Littlefinger
misdirection.
Totally.
Almost, wasn't it?
Could be.
But, you know, Littlefinger is the one guy in this whole thing that you don't know his agenda until he chooses to cut all...
He's like the perfect villain because he doesn't have to monologue when he reaches his triumph. I mean, he pulls off all these machinations... And he doesn't ever brag or gloat about them. Maybe he does find a confidant much, much later in the story, but he's very impossible to read. And especially the way that this actor is portraying him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so in that scene, when they're at the tourney, in the book, the whole point of that scene, what Littlefinger stops by to have a little chat with Sansa, was just to illustrate... how gross it was that he was like had the hots for his old girlfriend's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Or not
yeah.
girlfriend, but you know, basically he had the hots for Kat when he was a teenager, and he's refocusing that on Sansa. But none of that was conveyed in the TV show, right?
I didn't really catch it in the TV show. I didn't really...
Just kind of, I guess, how he was...
Think about that.
Kind of, not really.
I think that he, I mean, the story he chose to tell, he could have told her about anything. anything at all. And he chose to tell her this story so he could watch the fear on her face and feel joy. Like, that's Baelish.
But it's not the story he told her in the book. Is it? I don't think that's
what it's
happened.
Because the story, no, the story comes from Sandor.
Sandor
himself.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
For me, I actually, I was thinking about it. That's that it was an interesting way that they did it in the TV show. But thinking back on it, I really liked the fact that the Hound shared that story with her because it kind of sets up this weird underground friendship that the Hound and Sansa share, at least later on in the first book. So I don't know.
Are they undermining that a little bit by moving
it
forward in the story?
Well,
now she's predisposed to feel sorry for him before she's ever scared of him, almost.
I guess the way I saw it was that he was like, if you tell him this, that you know the story, he'll kill you, so don't talk to him.
Yeah, thanks, Littlefinger. thanks for that.
I really enjoyed that part of the books. And we've talked about that in other podcasts, that the Hound is this horrible, gory thing, but there's this soft spot that he has for Sansa, and we don't know why. And I mean, I think he was totally drunk when he told her all of that, and he was in a vulnerable spot.
Wasn't
that
in the second book that he said all that?
Yeah.
No, it's in the first book.
It's in the
first book, because I'm looking at it in the first book, yeah.
But we...
it's when he's forced to escort Sansa back from...
After the
tourney?
After the tourney.
So it's not that far.
Isn't there a banquet
or something
after the tourney? Is that
the first intimate moment between
Sansa? You're right. There is,
there's
some
the
banquet
house?
Or something, because I remember Septa Mordain getting really drunk at the banquet.
Right.
Okay, it is.
Sorry, Throners, you're probably all screaming at us what happened and where it is, and we can't find it. Sorry. We only have Chad for about 5 more minutes. He has an obligation. So we're going to talk to Chad about his favorite moments in the show. So, Chad.
Well, how awesome was the introduction of Gregor Clegane? Clegane?
Yeah.
I always pronounce it Clegane in my
head. The mountain.
It was fairly understated. There's just sneaking him in there in a way.
I think throughout the book, he's kind of understated. He's like this legendary, horrible person that you never really hear that much about.
Mm-hmm. What does he call him in Princess Bride? He's like, this legendary thing! Like, that's what
I
always thought of Gregor. It's like, this humongous,
totally.
Really scary...
An evil Fezzik. That's Gregor.
But I thought that the Viserys scene with the Lady of the Night that he was with in the bathtub, I don't get the point of that. What was the point? Except to tell us about the dragon's halls?
But after that scene, Septa was telling Sansa a different story about the forging of the Iron Throne, and I loved that we got this, like, here's this legend from this perspective on how the dragon's halls and the Iron Throne, and then right away, we're like, no, this is how the Iron... It was a man. It was your ancestors.
Yes.
It was Bran the Builder. Isn't that a pretty fairy tale? And, yeah.
See, I think that's
an interesting part.
That's an interesting way of being able to display the nuances like that in the film... in TV version versus a book where you read people's thoughts and that sort of thing. So
Storytime in Westeros. And it was to show, again, how much of a douche he is.
Exactly.
That he was about to get some good play and... Nope.
After last week, I was hoping that they would escalate his shame by showing that he had to walk with the slaves instead of ride.
I thought the same thing when he was riding in the beginning of the
Daenerys
part.
Yeah, he's still comfortable and he still gets sexy time with Doria. And so he's still not really getting the full impact of
it. Wasn't the last episode the guy told him he had to walk and then all of a sudden he's back on his horse? What's up with that?
I don't think... Did he say you have to walk?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, something like that.
Remember at the very end when he was like, Jorah, kill these Dothraki
yes.
bastards or whatever. And then the guy just looked at him and he was about to get on his horse and he said, no, you get to walk.
I don't remember.
Walked away.
Right. But
that was such a big part of the book. Like, Danny was talking about how it was so shameful for him to have to walk behind everyone.
Well, the only thing I can think of is that it's a little too soon for him to be broken down that far. I guess they wouldn't have been able to have his little scene with Daenerys where he says, you don't order me around and, you know, don't give me that smelly new thing, Dothraki clothes, it smells of manure. I mean, that was a great scene.
That was
it really was.
But that almost really had to happen before... Well, I don't know. You know, in the book, I think he was broken down to the point where he had been walking for a few days before they have. And he's like... So at that point, he's like at his wit's end.
When I was reading the book, that's how I felt, was that Viserys was like, he was almost insane by the time.
He was unraveling completely.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where they're going to go in the next episode with him, because we still have one more episode
before
the Golden Crown.
Yeah.
We have.
So we've got
whatever next week's is.
They just stalled it, but I agree. I'm not sure that there was really any value to the tub scene. Discussing the dragon skulls. I mean, all I can think of is, you know, I'm picturing like writers in the writers' room, and they have like a list of story details, like plots that they have to hit, and then they have a list of like flavor text that they want to put in. It's like, oh, we have to talk about how the Iron Throne was forged, and we have to mention how the final dragon skulls were all deformed and stuff.
Well, and I
before
wonder
they
if...
died out for once, and we have to explain. Maybe this is what it was. We have to explain how long it's been since there was a dragon,
and how
distant Viserys is really from the legacy of his family. Maybe that's like the main point that they had to get across with this conversation.
Well, maybe in the next episode where Arya is going through and touching the skulls and everything, and maybe we don't see what they are, and she doesn't see what they are, but we know as the audience now what they are. Maybe it was a play.
Oh, okay, so they don't have to explain it. I mean, the way it's explained in the books, you kind of get the sense, oh...
she knows what they are already.
Arya must have stumbled across the dragon skulls that are stored away somewhere. So you're right. They had to plant that seed. She says, well, where are the dragon skulls now? Oh, the usurper probably had them smashed or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm hoping, that we get to see that part of her chasing cats and hear, overhearing the conversation and coming face to face with a humongous dragon skull.
Because in the scene where she finds the dragon skulls, she's in the dark there.
And so
I think without that exposition there, you know, I mean, we might have even been like, what the hell is that, you know, or something.
Well, I'm really excited to see what the dragons look like, because in my head they're awesome.
Yeah.
And I hope that they're just as awesome in the show.
Yeah, we were very pleased about last podcast. We were talking about the creatures in the series and how we haven't seen Ghost for a while. We haven't seen Grey Wind really ever. Where is the damn three-eyed crow? And we got a lot of things that I think a lot of us have
been asking about the three-eyed crow. Because I was very upset that Bran was only asleep for one episode. I know we're jumping back, but...
Yeah.
I mean, he was asleep for so long, and there was so much dream in the book, and they, like, completely just skipped over it. But now they're giving us pieces, which I'm okay with.
Yeah, I hope they keep it up. I hope it builds and builds.
So much was predicated upon that. It's kind of like we have to move the story forward. Kat has to leave to get here in time to meet up with Tyrion, which actually worked out perfectly by the end of the episode. And the way they started with Tyrion being back at Winterfell and then having Tyrion arrive at the inn at the very end, I think timeline-wise, I'm totally happy with the way the characters are lining up where they're supposed to be. I mean, it was weird when Kat showed up in King's Landing all of a sudden without any reference to how she got there.
It's not next door to Winterfell?
Right.
They're not neighbors?
And they didn't even explain the whole shit. I took a ship, you know, and he didn't cut off his thingies and Roderick, facial
his
hair.
His side whiskers.
Thank you.
Wasn't it face whiskers? Something like that.
He didn't cut
off
his
thingies. He didn't. He should have been shaved by that point.
Yeah.
He should have been shorn.
By the time they got to King's Landing, he should have been, so that nobody recognized him in the brothel and all that.
Marillion ought to have been a little wispier and wimpier looking.
And more annoying.
And
instead
more,
of just
more annoying.
Like, hungrier looking. Like, I'm desperate for a meal and going to annoy the hell out of you until you buy me something to eat.
I mean, well, maybe it speaks to how dim his character is, but he ought to have recognized Sir Roderick as a Northman because he wasn't shorn.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
A lot of sense.
And you know who else we got to see this episode that we've been talking about way more than we should?
My favorite.
Hodor!
Yes!
Yeah!
Hodor!
Oh, that was great.
Hodor.
So glad.
It's like Hodor's dad, though, right?
Right? Hodor the first.
I did picture him as much younger, but then again, I pictured all of these characters younger. I'm sorry, Rob and Jon Snow are hot, and they're 15 in my head. That's not right.
No.
That's not right.
Oh my god, that's awesome. Yeah, Tarly.
I was really happy to see Tarly, too. Very happy to see him.
Yeah, Samwell Tarly. Such a key figure who is introduced very deftly, really.
Mm-hmm.
And they accelerate key points in his story. They waste no time. Like they introduce him in the battle in the yard, and he's a complete wimp, and he says, "I'm a coward." Does he ever call himself coward or always craven?
Ooh.
He says the word. I remember the word coward because I remember them making a point in the book about how he called himself a coward. Why nobody ever calls himself a coward? Like,
right.
I remember that word being in there.
Yeah.
Oh, and those conversations, they're flavoring Pip and Gren's characters.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, there's... Now, in the books, though, it was always Pip and Gren and a third guy. And they've condensed them into just two characters. But the Gren is sufficiently dopey, and Pip is sufficiently jokey. And they got in the first of the many... Pip making fun of Gren for being stupid and tricking him into saying,
I'm
so stupid.
That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
I like those guys.
Was
the
third,
whole thing
but there's at least one more in there.
Was the third, because, okay, which character is it in the book that is the one that says, no, I'm not gonna lay off Sam, I'm gonna cut me off a slice of bacon or whatever, and then they, because
yes.
it isn't, I thought, was he one of the characters that, like, ends up being part of their group later on?
No.
Or was he,
actually,
I don't
maybe.
Remember.
But, I mean, they're using the raper.
Well,
there's
they all
rat.
Kind of end up accepting Sam in the end, don't they? Like, no one... I mean...
Well,
at least in their circle,
point,
at least.
Yeah.
Once Sam gets his assignment,
yeah.
there's at least one brother in the Night's
yeah.
Watch who's very, very resentful of that.
Yes, that's right.
There's always one brother in the Night's Watch who's resentful about something. It's probably the dude who has to shovel everything.
Yeah.
I'd be resentful. My assignment was to shovel. Anyway.
Yeah, well, one
Halder
thing.
Is the third guy.
Halder.
Halder, yeah.
Okay. He's unremarkable. I can't remember a single characteristic about Halder.
Yeah. He's the quarryman's son. I don't know.
Before I take off, can I just say that I thought that the Gendry part, I did not like that they came out with it right away, that he's Robert Baratheon's bastard.
Yeah, I thought they were
because I remember in the book, when I first realized it, it was, and I'm sorry if I'm doing a spoiler alert, but it was when Arya's on the road to the wall with the boys, and the Lannister men come, Cersei's men come,
mm-hmm.
looking for
oh, and they
a
both
boy,
think they're
and Arya
looking for them.
Thinks that's what that, yeah, they both think that Sue's looking, and that's when I realized, oh my god, Gendry's Baratheon's bastard.
They actually,
well, I realized
they
it.
It.
Maybe
they
I was just slow,
book.
Maybe I just didn't catch
but,
it.
But it took me, the thing is, it took me a while in the second book to realize that Gendry was the person from before in the first
mm-hmm.
book, because they set him up just as this, they give him a different name, isn't it? Is it Bull or something
yeah,
like
the,
that?
The
Bull.
The Bull.
Yeah, the Bull.
And then, but then he says, there's a part where he says, my name is Gendry, and that was what made me go, like, ping in the second book.
Right.
Because they don't explain
that
in the first
be,
book that
no.
he goes with Yoren. You
right.
just, you're just supposed to recognize
just
him from
him.
His Bull helmet.
But they do explain in the first book that the person he sees in the armory is one of Robert's bastards.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, he came to that conclusion fairly quickly in the book.
Yeah.
But he didn't walk right out and say, Robert's bastard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
He didn't say it out loud. He certainly didn't confide in Jory. But there's still more to the mystery for him to unravel. But they're totally accelerating the whole, you know,
see,
sort of problem solving aspect.
I think Gendry is a
yeah.
is a very big role in this.
I wrote down when we watched last night, Gendry equals heart. And I think it's just because the way that he looked, we don't know if he knows. Like, we don't know anything about him. And in the book I remember Eddard talking to his boss, not boss, that's not the right word, but and I'm thinking he knows, and like, does Gendry know, but nobody's told him, and he's just suspicious,
he
or what?
He never, I don't think he ever lets on that he knows.
But I love, like, through the rest of it, his relationship with Arya and all those guys, and what happens to them on their way to the wall, and the loyalty that's, like, forged in there, so I'm excited to see what they do with him.
One thing I'm a little leery of, talking about, like, aging the characters a bit, I mean, Gendry ought to have been young enough to sort of not flirt exactly, but sort of have a little chemistry with Arya.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy's just too old for
way
that to
too
happen.
Old.
Right?
Yeah.
Wait, but don't you think they've aged almost
yeah.
all of the characters
they
a lot
have.
More? Like,
yeah.
Catelyn, I did not picture as being as old as
they
she
went overboard
movie.
With her.
Mm-hmm.
But,
but
I guess, I think they're trying to what's his name? The guy who's playing Eddard Stark. He looks so old that I think they wanted somebody that was a little more on par with him. But I always imagine Eddard Stark as being an older man and Catelyn being kind of like the younger girl that, you know, like they all do. They all are sleeping with tiny little young girls. So.
Yeah.
Like Count Drago.
We bid you adieu. Hi, Chad.
Thanks for coming, Chad.
Thank you. See you guys later.
Can we go back to the Jory Jamie scene? I
yes.
had something that bothered me about that scene. No matter what kind of war stories you share with other dudes, I don't think that Jory would ever give a Lannister something that a Stark had entrusted him with to deliver to the king. Like, that bothered me a lot, that Jory's
yeah.
like, hey man, you remember me? We fought. Can I just leave this with you? It's for the king.
Yeah.
From the hand. Like, I don't, especially because Eddard confided in him, and it's like, he
yeah.
knows what the message is. What the hell? Why would you give that to a Lannister? Right?
That is a good point, yeah.
I don't get that part.
Well, I think it helps illustrate the fact that there's not out-and-out war with the Lannisters yet, despite the fact that of the conversation that we have between Cersei and Ned, where they all but say, we're enemies. But Joy's not in on that, apparently.
Yeah, he just wants to share a war story with a brother.
It's just very, it was very weird to me.
Well, I mean, Jaime is still a knight of the Kingsguard, and he's standing there on duty, guarding the king's chamber. On the face, everything's on the up and up.
Yeah, one thing for me that I've noticed, it seems like they're trying to make Jaime be a little more of a sympathetic, or at least a more character that you can understand a little bit more than in, because there's not a whole lot about him. There's not a POV character or chapter for in the first book, and we don't hear a lot about him except for
he's a background villain for the entire first book.
But all these things
that are revealing about him do get revealed in time. Well, and I think they're intentionally beefing up his character so that the viewer at home identifies with him.
Because in the, and that's another difference I think between TV and book, because in the book when he finally does become a POV character, you get into his internal thought process and you get to identify with him that way. And so instead I think they have to do something more with him ahead of time so that by the time you're supposed to start identifying with him, you can actually do that.
Right. Maybe that's what they were doing, but I was like, come on.
One
guy that they made a point of Eddard saying, I trust. The one dude is going to just, hey man, can I leave this with you? It's for the king.
At least Troy's coming off pretty cool. I mean, he's a cool character.
Yeah.
He's actually already fleshed out more in the show than he ever was in the books.
Mm-hmm.
But he's present, you know? And he has a future in the story as well.
I saw that scene for the upcoming when Ned turns his back on the king. Basically, I quit. And I thought of Jory.
Well, I was wondering if they would still have the hands tourney like day two. There's the scene.
Well, I hope
so,
because there's supposed to be the battle between Sandor and Gregor.
Sandor becomes he wins the purse or whatever at the end of the tourney. But there's that great scene in the morning where Ned has to talk Robert down from trying to participate in the melee.
Right?
Yeah, that's true.
And we've got to have some sort of connection between Sansa and the Hound.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to HBO.
Listen, to us. It did seem like they ended the tourney like it wasn't done yet. So.
Yeah.
So hopefully.
Yeah, that's true.
We're missing your tourney, she says. It's not over.
It was kind of neat how, like, as the tourney is going on, then that's at the same time Catelyn is arresting Tyrion, and it's like that's... Which I always love that moment, because it's like the catalyst for, like, everything that else that happens in the story.
Excellent cliffhanger moment, too.
Yeah.
Because that's where the chapter ends in the book. And you really, and Tyrion is like, totally, what the hell is going on here?
He felt completely in control.
So well played when he strolls in there and he taps his little gold coin on the table. He's like, what can we do about this?
And even when he's like, okay, I'm glad your dad has all these friends. And then he makes that face like, you're kind of dumb. But
don't
what's
understand.
The point here? And she's like, well, the point is
you're fucked, buddy.
Yeah.
Oh, I loved it when they mentioned the thing about Lord Walder taking another wife, and Tyrion just let out that little, or whatever.
Yeah. Way to set up
so
the
great.
Phrase.
So there's so much subtext in that scene. The way that Catelyn, she introduces the concept at like Harrenhal and the Black Bat, and the Walder Frey and the twins, and the whole notion that she's the son of.
She's the daughter of Tully. I love that she wasn't just like, I'm a Stark, but it was
that was the thought process that she went through in the book. She was talking about how she sees a lot of her father's bannermen, and so that's how she's going to use it.
Yeah,
right.
She goes, can I pull this off? This is, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it carefully. But it's a great way of exposition, too, and just sort of explaining that these lords all swear fealty to these other lords. Just awesome.
You could see on the actress's face, too, I think, that she was being very, like, cautious and trying to calculate this out as she was trying to do it, too.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, they show them both, like, almost they want to hide from Tyrion when he first walks in.
Don't call me out. And then he did. And then there was that face on a couple of the bannermen, too, where they're like, oh, she called me out.
Oh, she's
okay.
Sorry.
Yes, right. Lady Stark. Fine, Lady
I'll help.
Stark. Yeah.
I'm going to call on my honor.
That was great.
I had forgotten, though, that the first spark of kinship or you know, friendship between Bronn and Tyrion happened in that moment when he's like, who's going to give up their room for me?
That's what a sellsword is. I like that they begin it that way, because that, you've got to think that that's his motivation through
he's,
all
he's
of it.
He's an opportunist.
Mm-hmm.
And he's and shrewd. A shrewd opportunist.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, just from looking at him, a grizzled badass.
Yeah. I really liked the character of Bronn in the books. And,
me
and,
too.
So hopefully they'll make him just as BA in the TV show.
I thought, though, in the books that he was more of an underdog. Like, that he wasn't the biggest guy. He wasn't the oldest. He wasn't the most experienced. But he was damn good.
That's exactly how I saw him, too, was that...
But this guy looks like...
Grizzled.
I mean, you're just sitting there and you don't want to mess with him.
Yeah.
He shouldn't be intimidated. I think that's part when Tyrion names him as his fighter at the Vale. Like, that's part of the reason that they're like, ah, whatever.
You should be able to underestimate him.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think.
So, what did you guys think about the scene between Ned and Cersei?
At first when it started happening, I was like, oh, they're not even in the Weirwood. They're going to bring this out now with the, you know, the revelation. But
they
I
didn't
was
bring
glad
it
out,
though, yeah.
I was so glad that they didn't.
I mean, it was kind of an interesting, you know, precursor to what is going to happen.
That conversation.
Both
that conversation.
Of them kind of flexing their muscles a little bit.
Yeah.
It was really...
I'm not sure what Cersei set out to accomplish with that little scene, though. I mean, she obviously, she rolled her eyes, she had to get away from the tourney. And then she walks in, and it helps illustrate how uninterested in the tourney Ned is.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But what is, does Cersei really accomplish anything from that scene?
The first thing she says is, you're missing your tourney. It's almost like, you're not doing your duty, I'm your queen, I can order you around.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a flexing muscle, but the one moment that I liked was, in the book, Ned is explained as this, he is a soldier. He's blunt, he doesn't mince words, he does what he thinks is right, he's noble, but he's also... rough around the edges, which is why he's so out of place in King's Landing. So when he sort of sighed and exhaustedly said, what are you doing here? What do you want?
Mm-hmm.
That it wasn't him being annoyed. That's Ned Stark. Like, that's what I like about him in the books, is that he's a real...
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's the most real person, and you identify with him so much. And
well,
it's just, what do you want?
I think Cersei... because, I mean, for, like we were just talking about earlier... what's his name, gets killed in the tourney by Sir Gregor, and that was the guy that he wanted to question. So is it a matter of she's already hearing things and getting fishy about why Ned is doing things? What's he doing at the tourney? You know, maybe she heard from Pacelle that he has this book or something now, or
right.
that he checked out the same book, and so maybe, you know, the death of Sir Gregor, I mean, that I can't remember in the book if they explain if we ever find out if that was accidental or if that was planned.
Well, you've got to assume if Baelish knows that he's
mm-hmm.
reading this book, she knows.
Yeah.
And she does go there and say, I was hoping we could put what happened on the
yeah.
King's Road behind us, so it was like an attempt to make peace.
I think she's just trying to, I think she's trying to sniff about.
And
she
she's feeling him out to
yeah.
see how,
yeah.
how, what his level of antagonism is.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. And she drops one very interesting detail. She says, your brother was the one who was bred to lead and you were bred to follow. And that plays off of the earlier conversation between Sansa and Septa Morgaine, when she's like, my uncle and grandfather were killed in this room, weren't they? And which plays off of a mention about it in the previous episode. So I love the fact that they're building up that parallel history
mm-hmm.
yes.
of everything that happened 17, 18, 20 years ago during the rebellion when... Ned and King Robert were all the hot-headed young teenagers. And, you know,
all this has happened before, and all this will happen again.
and that great conversation between John and Sam, where they're talking about having never slept with a woman, and John explains his noble reasoning for having not slept with the hot redhead Roz,
who even
got mentioned earlier between the conversation between Theon.
We're pretty
and
sure
Tyrion.
Roz was the one who was sucking off Tyrion in the first
yeah.
episode.
Didn't
That's
he
right.
have the very first line in the whole show? Isn't that why when IMDb was posting all the stuff before the series started, there was this redheaded whore
red-headed
that was on the cast? I think that's Roz.
And then they changed it. I think she's actually credited as being Roz.
As Roz.
As Roz.
Yes.
Gets around.
I wonder if your dad noticed the bongs that were on Master Paisel's desk.
Yeah, no, I don't think my dad would have noticed the bongs that were on Paisel's desk. Maybe he noticed the bathtub scene. Or maybe, I don't know, he might be interested in the wolves because he...
Molly's dead, chicken in, on the Game of Thrones.
Yeah, hi. It was a pretty good week. What I especially liked was the new fat boy. The mama's boy, you know, the one that joined the Black Watch and everybody beat the hell out of until Jon Snow stepped in. But I finally figured out why Jon Snow likes this guy so much. You see, they had a mutual confession with each other. Number one, that neither one of them had ever been laid, and that Jon Snow came close, but he didn't want to make a bastard. That's why he had his clothes off, the whore was ready to go, and he declined. But you see, I think, and because he's taken a vow of celibacy, being on the Black Watch, I think what's happened is this. He likes that fat boy because he can do him without creating a bastard, and, more importantly, think about it, how cold it is up there. That fat boy will keep him warm in the winter and shady in the summertime. I really like the way that Danny's coming on, figuring out now that she's a queen and, you know, putting that little asshole brother of hers in his place. I think he isn't long for this world. I like the old guy. He kind of reminds me of Merlin. But you know what's really neat is everybody around that place is treacherous. They're all treacherous. And I kind of like the confrontation where the queen came in to test the waters with Ned, and they decided, although they knew it all along, that they were both enemies. Peter? You see the skinny guy, right? That's the little finger, and he told, at the jousting tournament, he told the gal the story of the two brothers. Tell her their names, the Hound and the Mountain. I think he's as slimy as they come. Kind of looks like Arch a little bit. You don't know which side anybody's going to fall on this except Ned and the Queen. Those and her brother. There's good, there's evil. You know, everybody else in between, I think, is waiting to see which way the wind blows, or they want to make the wind blow their own way. So that's what intrigues me about it. But I guess that's why it's called Game of Thrones. The bathtub scene with the whore, that was all right. That was all right, but I don't know. I like the scene a little bit more her. No, a whole lot more her. And that's about it. It was kind of benign, really. You know, the only fun thing was the fat boy. The dream sequel. You know, I still haven't figured all this out. Like, man, there's going to be some bad stuff coming down. Bran fits into all this somehow. I haven't quite figured it out yet. And we know that Lassiter, the imp, did not try to kill him. But we know the guy that did had his knife. So how does all this come down? And now... I think Ned's wife has really put herself in a bind arresting the imp. And from the scenes from next week, there's going to be some hellacious fighting. But you know who I really like is the youngest daughter, the one that's taking the sword fighting lesson. Somehow she's going to come out of this. She's going to be the one that comes out on top. That's all I got this week. Nothing exciting.
Molly's dead. Chicken in. On the Game of Thrones.
Even you, Chuck, were talking about how we might not see... Ghost or any of the wolves unless they're being used to threaten
someone. I was
someone.
A little disappointed the ghost just popped up out of nowhere. Just like I said, I hope they don't just bring the wolves in when they're
right.
about to attack
It seems
somebody.
Like they're going to be a deus ex machina, and I really am going to hate that if they are.
Well, and Greywind? I mean, when Rob is sitting there as Lord of Winterfell and Tyrion's trying to figure out what the hell's going on,
Greywind is lying there.
Like,
but Greywind is not up there like growling.
No, but he
face.
Was the presence. Like I think it was a little threatening. It was a little intimidating.
But I mean, if they can just show a dog in the background in one scene, why can't they show a dog in the background in all the other scenes just to get
to
just to indicate
there, yeah.
that he was ever at the wall?
Money for the animal trainer.
I did appreciate the one little moment when Theon enters Bran's room and Summer's all growling.
Yes,
at him.
That was great.
I did, speaking of Theon and some other things that I was noticing, I'm in the first third of Clash of Kings. Sorry, are you looking at my notes here?
No, Shark on a Mountaintop.
Shark on a Mountaintop.
Jamie described Theon as, he looked
shark.
Like a shark on a mountaintop. What?
Wow.
What?
Let's get somebody to do a velvet painting of that. But there's actually stuff that they're putting in this episode that I just read recently in Clash of Kings, which is the second... A lot of exposition, like
right.
the talking about the battle at Pike
mm-hmm.
and some of Theon's past.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's interesting that I wouldn't have recognized that had I not started Clash of Kings. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, that's from the second book already.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to the way they're enhancing Jaime's character a little bit
mm-hmm.
early.
Mm-hmm.
They finally got around to in this episode giving an awful lot of backstory to Theon.
Yeah.
You know, with his encounter with Tyrion in the beginning, where Tyrion basically says, "So you're a prisoner here." No, it's not like that at all. Okay, whatever. Have it your way.
And they never mention him being a prisoner until the first time that we hear him talk in that he has his POV chapter in Clash of Kings.
Right, Rob trusts him implicitly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they don't quite show them being quite so chummy. And that was one person made a comment, or it might have been you, that he didn't kick the head at the beheading in the first episode.
That was not me, but that is an interesting...
You know, that was Theon's always smiling. Everything is sort of a joke and a game to him. But this character, this actor who's portraying Theon, is not always smiling. Mm. He's just always just kind of like grumpy looking.
Yeah.
And he looks like a teenage Mick Jagger, sort of.
Yeah. Well, in the books, I remember him being a prick because of his actions. He would do prickish things, like kick the head and say, like, horribly inappropriate things, and everybody would be like, oh my god, shut up, Theon. But now... everybody's just talking shit and giving him a hard time, and the actor sort of doesn't deserve it right now.
Theon was always, he was a smart ass.
Yeah.
Right.
But this Theon is just,
the brunt of a lot of anger that,
like,
we don't really understand.
Well, yeah, at least in this episode they illustrate that he's got a little simmering resentment. But prior to that, he just seemed loyal. And I mean, he was Ned Squire, and
he was going to kill the puppies.
Happy to take,
so,
exactly.
Yeah.
He just follows his orders. And Jory says, good lad. And Jamie says,
yeah.
Is he? Or I doubt it.
Is he? Or is he a shark on a mountaintop with the guitar?
No. Should we talk about the dream sequence?
Please. Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
I saw that raven, and I saw Bran standing up, and I went, oh! And I was really hoping that when they bring out the raven and his third eye, that it was going to look cool, because it could look really stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And really awesome.
Just, yeah. Well, in a very short amount of time, they established this is a dream.
Mm-hmm.
I am following this thing. It has a third eye. Holy shit.
Yeah.
And then he wakes up, so it's a dream.
And
yeah.
Summer's
The raven is heading towards the crypt, isn't
he? Yeah, towards the... Because he lands on the two wolves there.
Wolves, the entrance to the crypt, which I don't think the casual viewer would have any idea that that's the case. But at least there's the iconography of the wolves.
Mm-hmm.
So when they revisit it, and the next dream goes a little further down the passageway.
Mm-hmm.
They might even do several dreams to the point where they get all the way down in the crypt.
Yeah.
And he has a revelation.
I wonder if they'll have the raven talk.
Right?
He does talk to him.
What is the revelation? Does he get all the way down there and he sees the tombs of all of the dead lords of...
Yes.
And until he finally sees the most recent dead
lord.
The
giant over city, like there's a flying part of the dream too.
Yeah,
I'm hoping that they go so far as to link him with Summer in one of these dreams. Like it gets to that point where
I think it's
that's the next season kind of.
I know,
thing,
but
though,
I'm hoping that it'll like the dreams will last. Now that they've set it up that we get these little pieces, the loyal readers are going to expect those little pieces.
Well, and I think the way that they're doing that, rather than showing us the dream before he wakes up earlier in the series, I think the way they're doing it with this retrospective thing, where he's still having like recurring bits of these dreams, I think that's almost on TV. I think that's more effective somehow because rather than whereas you know having this big huge dream that happens in the book before he wakes up, works in the book, you know.
Yeah.
So.
It's so jam-packed, too. That chapter is, like, chilling.
Yeah.
So.
It's gorgeous and chilling.
Yeah.
Hey, doll.
I was just really happy when he walked in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Carry him.
Mm.
I was really happy that they had that scene, too, where Tyrion had written his diagram for the saddle that would help
that is one
Bran
thing
ride.
That Molly
it was
even said that before the episode.
Such a gesture
like,
of
I
kindness.
I really hope.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and when Catelyn finds out about it, I mean, she has doubts anyway, but I remember in the books being like, she needs to know what he did for Bran, because how could somebody try to kill him and then, like, try to make him feel great about himself now?
Yeah. And I'm glad they have stuff like that, because one of my favorite things about Tyrion in the books is that, from a certain perspective, he does some things that some people might consider a little, you know, cold or cynical or that sort of thing, but any of Tyrion's flaws or bad side things that he does, I guess, seem driven entirely out of being forced into a cynical perspective because of how he's grown up in his family, I think. But other than that, at least I really like Tyrion.
I do.
So.
But until we encounter Lord Tywin, well, I shouldn't say that. actually things are going to start getting very bad for Tyrion very quickly
from
this point forward in the story.
Yeah.
But up till now, he's been sort of footloose and fancy free.
Mm-hmm.
He's just the you know, lucky to be a lord's son.
Yes.
And living it up accordingly.
And he knows it. Very much knows it. I'm so excited to see the Vale, the Eyrie. I want to see him fly and just all these amazingly architectural things from the book with Tyrion's cell just having no wall and it's just the drop like
we
that.
Keep
they keep showing it falls.
The jailer
getting the throws him to the floor.
Else. I'm really looking forward to that.
And that jailer, dirty, gross, smelly man. I can't wait to
Can
see
Can you
that
see
guy.
The snow leopard's cloak in that scene, I wonder?
I didn't see it, but was it
the jailer
snow
should
leopard?
Be wearing.
Yeah, that's right. Because he took it off him.
I'm very curious.
The Shadow Cat
to,
or whatever it was.
Shadow Cat.
Very curious to see what young Lord Robert looks like.
Wait, we already know Lysa's not going to look anything like she's supposed
That's
to.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah.
Or Lysa. Because
she looked very frail and
I want
really?
To tell if Brendan made me a Mother's Day card. I had kind of a crazy Mother's Day weekend. Like, my kiddo went to the ER and she's fine. But she went to the ER on Saturday. There was blood and Free Comic Book Day and it was crazy.
Where did blood come from Free Comic Book Day?
Her nose and her head, and she passed out at Legend Comics. Like, yeah, anyway, it was crazy, and so he made me this awesome Happy Mother's Day card, and you should read it out loud.
Out loud? Okay. It says, "This is a day to honor all the mothers who tend to their children with dedication. Whether it's lovingly brushing your daughter's hair, or staring balefully at your bastard stepson, breastfeeding your kindergartner, or passing off your incestuous offspring as your husband's get, mothers are a gift to the world. Happy Mother's Day."
Yes, so those four women from Game of Thrones... I hope I'm never like any of them.
Even though, okay, on this, and
it's
I was
really
just asking.
Great card.
I was just asking what young Robert looks like, and then you passed me this card, and the little, even though they're blurry, they look like death in that picture.
Yeah, there's a photo of some of the characters on the front underneath the text on the card, and it's just
you have young Robert and Eliza.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God! Yeah, great card. Great Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to all those.
Do you think we'll get? I mean, we've seen a lot of breasts in this show. We've seen rape in this show. We've seen murder in this show. Do you think we'll see a breastfed kindergartner in this show?
I hope so.
Oh boy!
Certainly
oh boy!
So.
I'm sure that will probably create much more stir among a lot of people than
the next Got Milk campaign
oh,
to ever show on HBO.
Please, oh, please.
Will be. Robert turning around from his mother's breast and saying it.
Okay, I have to say that this episode, the music for me was more... It took me out. It just seemed like when there needed to be suspicious-sounding music, there was suspicious-sounding music.
Mm.
And when there was a long speech, we had some underscoring that was threatening. And it just was... The fact that I wrote down, you know, Baelish, we had music that was suspicious again with Ned and... We had music under Thorne's speech that was, like, creepy and awful, and I'm eating people music, and, you know. And then there was just some moments where the music would get all ambient and sort of rise and swell, and usually I like that.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, I didn't quite like it. It wasn't interesting
in this
enough.
Episode?
It just, yeah, it just
you know,
sort of
I didn't,
seemed,
I didn't,
like, stock.
I didn't
know.
Notice it in this episode. But, like, I just, I guess I didn't. The music didn't strike me in this episode. Maybe that's my equivalent of what you're saying.
Yeah.
But because in the other episodes, there were like moments in the music where I was like, "Oh, I like this. I like this," and then I guess I didn't really notice the music in this episode. So maybe
it seemed like the music was acting too much. You know,
acting.
Those actors that they just have to stand there and receive the information, and they're like acting their way through it. It seems like the music was.
The music
just like,
can tell you how to feel.
Come on,
right?
Although
if it's a little too heavy-handed.
Yeah, I think
but,
that's what it was. It was a little too heavy.
Well, maybe they feel like it needs
well,
a little goose,
know.
Though, for those viewers that aren't quite sure what's happening. And they're not quite sure what to think of some of these
characters.
I know,
I don't like being handed something.
To me,
like,
yeah.
I know Baelish is, like,
but,
you should be, he tells us, you should be suspicious of me. I don't need
which
stock
is the most
cartoony
awesome,
suspicious
the most awesome
music.
Line for that character to utter.
Yeah.
It's just, you know,
mm-hmm.
That was the wisest thing you did since you arrived in King's Landing, was distrusting me. Because... How awesome to say that right to his face and then
smirk.
Be distrustful later.
He wants your daughter. Hide your kids. Hide your wife.
Because there's a little finger
oh
in it.
Oh my God. And yeah, the little finger, he explains the little finger reference.
Yes.
I never really thought, I mean, when I read it,
ooh.
I was like, okay, that makes sense. But in his delivery in this episode, I was like, oh, it's because your cock is small.
my dad about that. The Baelish story, like the way that, I know we already talked about it, but the way he told that story, that actor, when he was on The Wire and he played the mayor, Tommy Carchetti,
mm-hmm.
watching The Wire, he was one of my favorite people on The Wire, and it was because of his voice. There was always this tone in his voice, and because he played a politician, it was interesting to see what the actor did with his voice when he was speaking just to, like, his confidants or speaking to a large group of people or whatever. And in this show, it's, like, hearing him tell that story.
Because
we were talking in that first episode about Arya commenting to Sansa that this was Jaime, and we were getting information through these fun voiceovers, and we were hoping they would do that more. I loved that they chose Baelish to tell the story.
Yeah.
So we could hear those voices and the, you know, see the fear. Like, I love it. I love it. I hope they do more of that to give us information.
Yeah, that scene, that him telling that story really sucked me in, actually, and it was because of the actor's voice, actually.
Oh,
he had this, I don't know, there was just this very, I don't know, there was this strange sort of
guttural
quality to it that just, like, really...
He's from Ireland, so he's an Irish
actor.
He's
got a very Irish accent.
Yeah.
This kid, did he have an Irish accent on The Wire?
No, he was from Baltimore. I mean,
yeah.
It was Tommy Carchetti. Like, that was his name. He was fantastic.
That's
in
crazy
that, show.
That he's like an... I mean, HBO recasts people frequently on their shows, but the fact that they moved to Ireland and they got the guy that was originally from there to be Irish.
Pretty amazing.
I have to bring up a point that was brought up by one of our listeners, who called you out for misidentifying the actor who portrays Jorah Mormont as having been in Braveheart. What did you remember Ian Glynn having been in before?
I remembered him in, I thought he was in Braveheart. I know he plays Ewan McGregor's dad in Trainspotting.
Yes.
And he's also in an adaptation of one of my, he's in a movie that's an adaptation of one of my favorite Kurt Vonnegut short stories.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Which one?
Cannot remember the name of the movie, but it's of Harrison Bergeron. It came out a couple years ago. Not the one with Sean Astin, because that one sucks.
Okay. Well, I was looking at his IMDb page, and I thought it was very interesting. He's been in all kinds of neat stuff.
Yeah.
He's in, like, a recent Doctor Who episode, which is probably the least of his cool things.
Well, like, who did I
but,
think he was in Braveheart?
I
played,
didn't see that.
You
thought
know,
that he was his dad, didn't you?
He thought that he was, I think you thought
William
that he was
Wallace's
Brendan Gleeson's dad in,
maybe.
I think that's, because he looks kind of similar to that actor, but I don't think it's the same actor.
The cool thing that Ian Glynn was in, he plays Hamlet in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Very nice.
Here we go. This is, I confuse these guys all the time. James Cosmo. They look alike, and maybe that's what I thought
we're
he
looking
was
at pictures on a
okay,
iPod
okay
right now.
I think, I maybe, see.
Okay, are we talking,
that's
Mormont. Okay, so then I was right. Mormont on the Wall is who I was.
That's
talking
yeah.
About.
That's what
okay.
I thought.
Yeah,
that's what
I
thought
you were talking
about.
Not Jorah.
I knew
okay.
You were talking about
okay.
Commander.
So
no wonder I'm confused.
Well,
okay.
Hey.
Because
you guys
like,
were all thinking about the older.
Yeah,
Mormont.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
He also played Santa, or I'm sorry, Father Christmas in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yes, he did.
By Walden Media.
Hated that movie. Sorry.
It has problems.
It does have problems.
But one thing it does have in abundance is CGI animals. Something this show can learn about.
Give us the creatures. It was really great to see ghosts. When I first watched the episode, I didn't like how John is only talking to Gren and Pip, and the rest of the lunchroom kids are supposed to hear him,
yeah.
You know, and I didn't think that was happening because this, like, they had noises in the background, like there were tons
the lunch
of
room,
people
the
in the
lunchroom. The lunchroom, the mess hall,
they,
or
what's
the
it
feast
called?
Hall.
Go clean the something. He says. And
well,
go,
that's the armory. That's
that
a different.
Is,
right.
That's
okay.
Different. Yeah.
I was pictured as being sort of cathedral sized big mess hall, that because there's.
I'm gonna call it McDonald's.
Right.
Just,
the little kid in the cafeteria. It was just weird the way that. Like, out in the yard, you know, there's these little tiny groupings, and John is talking, but the extras have been told to focus on what they're doing, and it doesn't look like anybody's actually listening to him. And he's supposed to be gaining this reputation as, like, being a rebel, and Thorne is this man to be feared. And so when we got to the cafeteria scene, and he says this to Gren and Pip, and they're sitting all by themselves, and then the Raper comments, and everybody starts laughing, I didn't expect that, because the way that the scene was set up, it was like... Yes, he was saying it loudly, so maybe the dude behind him could hear, but I didn't think that it...
The whole table could hear in
the Yeah, I don't think they've earned that.
I don't know, but they're trying to squeeze in an awful lot of detail where they can, you know. I give them credit for conveying an awful lot of backstory and detail in all sorts of unexpected little places that are, you know, highly effective. During the Hans tourney, the mountain's shield depicts one dog. Shouldn't it be three?
Well, yes. He did have the three dogs on the back of the horse.
And Hugh of the Vale had the...
John Aaron symbol.
John Aaron's symbol. It was, right?
Mm-hmm.
The hawk and the crescent.
Yep.
One?
Yeah. And then all the banners in the back. I mean, there were more than three dogs, I think, on the banners that were hanging up. There was a Lannister.
So having been
Clegane.
John Aaron's squire earned him the right to his, like, house... symbol, or
well, they did say he was they did mention that he was knighted right after he died,
and he is of the Vale, so
of the Vale, but the Vale has all sorts of heraldry for different houses and things as well.
Yeah.
But if he's a knight of the Vale, doesn't that mean he's like serves the house of Aaron still as a knight?
So then, well, I guess we don't know what family he belongs
to.
And
in the book, he's only mentioned as because I just looked over that when we were talking about him dying earlier, but it only calls him the young knight of the Vale.
Well, if he becomes knighted right after John Aaron was killed, maybe he just sort of assumed John Aaron's armor and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm a knight. You can't talk to me.
Which reminds me, that's one detail I was going to mention I liked about the previous episode where old Nan is asking Bran in bed which stories he would like to hear. She says, what about Sir Duncan the Tall? Those were always your favorite. And have you guys read any of the Duncan Egg stories?
No.
No, I haven't.
Or do you even know about them?
Tell us, Chuck.
Really? As George R. R. Martin has been publishing the novels of A Song of Ice and Fire, he also has been editing a series of short story collections, and in each one of them, he puts in a Dunk and Egg story, which is a story featuring characters that live in Westeros about 100 years prior to these stories that take place in the novels.
Where do we pick this up?
I was just talking to Chad Sfigera, who just left, about the Gunslinger series, Stephen King's Gunslinger series, and how I absolutely love that the series connects to, like, what, 15 other books that King has written with characters and interweaving, and I love that. And I wish that George R.R. Martin was doing more of that, and he is.
He's been doing that. He just last year published the third Duncan Egg story.
Cool.
And so it's a young hedge knight who picks up a young squire. So and so he's just the adventures of a young hedge knight. But later on, you find out that, or you know, if you read between the lines, you know that young Sir Duncan becomes a knight of the Kingsguard named Sir Duncan the Tall.
I'm so excited about this. That makes me very happy.
So,
okay.
And where did you
stuff.
Find it, you said?
There's three short story collections. One that's called Legends. One that I can't remember, the most recent one is called Warriors.
Didn't he do that with, before A Game of Thrones came out, he did that with Daenerys' chapters as well? I think there were...
There is a book where it was just Daenerys' chapters forming a novella. I can't remember what the name of it is.
Up until
Blood of the Dragon?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was published as a separate story, right?
Before Game of Thrones
I'm
came out.
I'm being so out-nerded right now. So out-nerded.
The wonders of Wikipedia.
I know. One scene that we haven't talked about at all is the scene with Arya and Ned, and how the standing on the toes.
So great.
Yeah.
So the progression of how Arya is just eating up the teachings of Syrio.
That's not me.
That was such...
Not me.
That was a very powerful, simple line.
Yes,
that's
it
very
was.
Me. Yeah.
The
just
disappointment
kind of...
on that little girl's face.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go stand on my toe so I don't ever have to do what you just said I'm expected to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Was so great.
And Ned's accepting of that. What other guy at that time, or at least in the books that we've read, would be like that? You know, would accept that his daughter's gonna...
Certainly not
that.
Samuel Tarly's father.
Yeah, exactly.
Another reason, just another reason why I like Ned so much.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, yeah.
I was disappointed that Samwell confided that tale to Jon so quickly. It's like, why are you at the wall? Well, let me tell you my deep, dark secret. It took him a good long time before he sort of confessed something that personal.
Yeah.
But I guess they're just sort of accelerating their relationship a little bit.
Well, I remember him saying something, though, to John, that something very personal, that is the reason that John tells the others to lay off him, though. I remember that.
Was it just the coward stuff?
I don't remember if it was that story or what it was, but I remember there being something that he told him that made him like go tell the others we're gonna go easy on it.
Yeah. I did like the reciprocation of John telling him about Roz. I mean, that was a very vulnerable thing to tell someone.
It was, yeah. They're good buds now.
Yeah.
For sure. Even just in the little bit that we've seen on the show, I think the casual viewer has to recognize that Sam is maybe the only character smart enough really to identify with John, because Grin and Pip are kind of dopey.
There was something the actor playing Sam did in this episode that I really liked. John was saying, you know, what's my name? And he says, and why am I so? And then he did this thing where he said, because you're a bastard of the North. He like nodded his head, like almost like it's knowledge that he's memorized. And
exactly.
I don't want to offend you, so I'm going to recite it.
I really liked that because that acting touch there.
Is this a trick?
And
question?
I love the fact that they explained that so explicitly, because it is such a neat detail.
They talked about, I remember that having its own couple paragraphs in the book. And it was very nice and simplified, saying that that's how why he's named Snow.
Okay, in the last episode, Littlefinger tells Kat and Ned that he lost the Valyrian steel dagger to Tyrion at a tourney when the Knight of Flowers defeated Jaime Lannister.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was going to build up to the reveal of the glorious Knight of Flowers that like sort of won everybody over at the Hand's tourney.
Maybe we'll see him later, because I was just looking over that chapter, and it did have the description of, she says what was the most horrible thing first, and then it talks about Sir Loras coming out and handing her the flower, handing Sansa the flower. So maybe they're just going chronologically. I don't know.
Okay,
that was a really great chapter.
I do want to see him.
Sansa is very, when you read about Sansa, it's very much like Cersei. She has all these thoughts that she can't ever say aloud. And she's been trained to be this very polite, very proper girl. But when you read Sansa's chapters, this does not mean I like her. But when you read Sansa's chapters, you get a sense that she knows exactly what her place is. And it's so polar opposite from Arya, that when someone does say something, I mean, even when the Hound is in her face, she knows exactly what to say. She knows how to be charming. And even if she is afraid, the words she says, regardless of what her face is giving away, the words she says are always, like, perfect.
What
and
was
I,
it that
doesn't
she's,
he say
which
that
in
to
her,
her
in
you
her
always
own
know
way,
what to say?
It's fairly shrewd to always be doing that.
Well, and, because it was, I remember that it was from Septimorde. She keeps saying, what did Septimordane say? Courtesies are a woman's shield, or something along
yes.
that
yes,
yeah.
yes, exactly.
Yeah. Which
and
is probably why Cersei likes her so much, that, I don't know. I don't think Cersei actually
in spite
likes
of
her,
herself
but,
she likes her
though.
I will be interested to see, of course this will not start happening until the end of the first season and hopefully into the second season. I will be interested to see Sansa's transformation as a character though, actually, because I actually do like her by the second and third book
by her wedding. Oh lord,
oh dear god, yeah.
You don't know
god.
That Brendan
I don't yeah.
Well, I mean, come on, she's Sansa Stark, she's gotta get married.
Most outwardly cruel thing though, and she doesn't kneel to help Tyrion do the thing.
What?
Nothing. Spoilers!
It's impossible not to spoil this story.
What?
Well, it has to
just,
do with...
Just tell me to put earmuffs
just,
on.
Too late. Anyway.
Moving on, so that Brendan can forget.
Should we go around and talk about our favorite things, gentlemen, or do we have other things to talk about?
I think we can wind down at this point. Brendan?
Well, I just, again, I really notice all the details and props and stuff that they have in the background. Like, I really liked the tapestry that has the Battle of the Trident behind
it. Is
the
that
console.
What it was?
Yeah,
I wanted
it's,
to
it's,
go back and...
I'm pretty sure, from what that it's the Battle of the Trident. Maester Purcell's bongs on his desk.
Was there actual bongs?
It looks like bongs.
There were bongs.
Two vials, and I'm just like, those are bongs.
And there were, like, at least two things that were smoking.
Yeah. And though I really hate Viserys, I'm gonna say there's some time that I'm going to use descriptions of dragons as foreplay, because it just seemed to work.
That was pretty awesome. He was very Baltar in that scene. He was, you know, the cocky, like, you really don't like him, but he's so damn charming, and you want to see what he's gonna do next, and he's such a douche. Like Baltar. Anyway. This is not actually part of the show, but it's an HBO thing that I like. The at the very beginning, before they say, and now, or maybe it's at the same time, and now.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, HBO's original series. They have the Iron Throne sitting there.
Split screened with...
No, before that.
Okay.
They have the Iron Throne sitting there, and then the logo of the script, A Game of Thrones, is on top of it, and then there are these big, humongous wings that branch out, and then there's smoke.
Dark wings.
And then there's smoke. And then they disappear, and it's just a very cool, like, HBO effect,
yeah.
And that right there is, like, the mystery stuff that the series and the books are all about for me. So I really... Every time I watch that, it's very much like the beginning of when we used to watch Battlestar Galactica,
mm-hmm.
and the title sequence, and you would try to see everything that's going to happen in the episode in that one little part of the title sequence,
yeah,
that they would show you, or the universal theme,
yeah,
where you would fist pump in the air, those two beats, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Everybody
did
that.
That's neat.
So that right there is just as exciting for me as...
And the cracking ice when you see the direwolf
start
screen with the iron stone.
Like, all of that stuff, and still the title sequence is just as exciting as ever, so I'm really enjoying those little things.
Yeah.
How about you, Eric?
My favorite part was Baelish's retelling of the story of Gregor Clegane. Actually, I want to like curl up with the blanket and a mug of cocoa and have that actor just tell stories to me.
Watch The Wire.
So, okay, I will. Chuck?
There are a lot of good stuff we've talked about. One thing that we didn't touch upon, that scene that you just mentioned where Ned Stark follows Grandmaster Pycelle back to his quarters, and the actor is just portraying Grandmaster Pycelle beautifully.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He's sweaty, and that's one thing, you know, they keep portraying King's Landing as being somewhat tropical, almost. There's these lush gardens and everything, and I do recall now in the books, Grandmaster Pycelle was often just sort of sweaty and tired.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Because of the overwhelming heat, he couldn't handle it. And they portrayed that in this episode. And they also, I mean, he snuck in, it's maybe a little bit of heavy-handed exposition. He's like, oh, did you know that Lord Varys is a eunuch?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the kind of person that would use poison as a weapon. How a person like that ended up on the King's Small Council, I'll never know.
He's genitalist.
Even though I've served the king for generations or whatever.
Yeah. I do like that they're casting more than one. I mean, right now, the Lannisters are painted as bad guys, so I'm glad that there was somebody else saying, well, keep this in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting also when they're strolling through the garden, Littlefinger and Ned, and Littlefinger's like, okay, that one over there, that's one of Varys's little birds, one of the spider's little birds, and you see the two little kids there, and it's like, well, you don't really find out so much later that Varys hires these little kids to be his spies for him. So I thought that was kind of upping the ante there a little bit.
I was going to say just on a quick side note about Pycelle, when that there was a chapter where you do find out he's hot all the time, and there was something about because he offered Ned some milk with honey in it or something like
the poppy
that.
Milk of the poppy.
No. It was he actually said iced milk with honey for refreshment, basically. And I just wanted to say one thing that I do miss from the books that you can't really portray on film is that the books make me hungry when I'm reading them because all the descriptions of every feast and everything that's
right,
everywhere.
The grease
yeah.
dripping down their fingers
yes.
from the chicken or whatever it is.
Rubbing them all over the horse meat.
Ew.
I have never wanted to eat horse until I read about the Dothraki.
Oh, and then finally they said Ser Jorah said the thing about how the Dothraki don't trust any water that the horse can't drink.
Yep.
Which is something we reflected on from the wedding scene where they're partying by the sea.
I wonder if we're ever going
nice to
hear Baelish.
Say that.
If we're going to hear Baelish mention Lady Tanda and the lamprey pie.
Lady
it's entirely possible. I mean, they mentioned Lady
yeah,
Gwent
have,
of Harry Hall. All kinds of little background characters are sneaking into this show in ways that I never thought they would.
Well, and this episode, we really
Lady
got.
Lady Tanda is Lawless's.
We got Hodor, Grey Wind, Tarly, whatever the dude's name is who died. We got Ghost back.
Hugh.
We got a dream sequence. We got Roz going around. We got, I mean, there and Danny finally growing some balls. We got a lot. We got a lot that I've been missing. Good episode.
Yeah. Totally.
Next one is the wolf and the lion. So yay for more of the wolf and the lion. The Lannisters.
Starks and Lannisters, buttonheads.
Maybe we do get that conversation where Cersei says the title line in the next episode.
Which is going to be great if it does.
Yeah.
Do it well.
All right, thanks everybody. We'll see you next week.
Dark Wings.
DarkWords.com.
A weekly Game of Thrones podcast.
Conceived by Chuck Davis. Produced by Boombox Productions. Recorded in Omaha, Nebraska. Featuring Chuck Davis, Chad Sfigera, Molly Welsh, Brendan J.D. Riley, and Eric Salonis. Join us for coverage on Episode 5, The Wolf and the Lion, at DarkWingsDorkWords.com, or look us up on iTunes and subscribe for free.